Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for tuning in. This will be a fun hour. We're talking about dinosaurs. This diverse group of animals has gripped the popular imagination since the word dinosaur was first coined in 1842. One of the earliest cartoons ever made in 1914 was a short called Gertie the Dinosaur. And we continue to celebrate them, particularly in books, TV, and films aimed at children. The Land Before Time, Dinosaur Train, Jurassic Park. Meanwhile, scientific understanding of dinosaurs continues to evolve. We now know that many dinosaurs had feathers, and they were not the lumbering, dim-witted creatures we once thought. They were, in fact, as varied as mammals. Every year, around a dozen new dinosaur species are discovered. Recent finds include a 10-foot-tall monstrosity from the Dakotas that has been dubbed the chicken from hell. And then there's the titanosaur discovered in Argentina in 2014, 122 feet long. It had thigh bones the size of living room couches. It was perhaps the largest animal ever to walk the earth that we know of. What do we know about dinosaurs that we didn't a decade or two ago? What do dinosaur experts hope we will learn in the years to come? And what might we never know? Dinosaur paleontologist Thomas Holtz Jr. is here to answer our questions. He is a senior lecturer in the geology department at the University of Maryland and the author of Dinosaurs, the most complete up-to-date encyclopedia for dinosaur lovers of all ages. Thomas Holtz Jr., welcome to Midday.
Hi, thanks.
I'm so glad that you are here. Were you one of those kids who was obsessed with dinosaurs?
Oh, absolutely. These are stories that go beyond my own personal memory, but my parents tell me, they have no reason to lie to me about this, that when I was really young and I first found out about dinosaurs, that I said I wanted to grow up to be a dinosaur. And then they had to explain to me that that couldn't happen, so I decided then and there that I would grow up to study dinosaurs. And unlike most people who make decisions when they're three, I actually stuck with it. So I have always been fascinated by dinosaurs. I've always known that I wanted to work on dinosaurs for a living and hoping to find people would pay me to do that. And eventually that happened. So,
what do you start out studying, by the way, as an undergraduate? If you're determined to be one who studies dinosaurs, did you major in biology?
Right, that's a great question. In fact, there's sort of two pathways. One is to work primarily in biology and zoology and pick up a lot of geology on the side, and the other pathway is to study a lot of geology and pick up a lot of the biology on the side. And I was a student, well, actually here in Baltimore at Johns Hopkins as an undergraduate. And at the time, in the mid-80s, there wasn't a lot of whole organism biology, so zoology and evolutionary biology and so forth, being taught in the biology department. They focus more on cellular and genetic stuff. So I was in the geology department, the Earth and Planetary Sciences department here, where, in fact, they even had classes in things like osteology, the study of bones and so forth, and as well as classic paleontology. So I went through the geological route, but had to study a lot on the biological side because paleontology really is an interdisciplinary field within the sciences. I mean, we're studying organisms, so we have to understand them. But the context they're in is in the rocks. We're finding the remains preserved in the rocks. You have to understand how the rocks got there, what environments they represent, when they were deposited in time, and so forth.
That makes sense. So, in other words, you have to be pretty clear on what that rock can yield and what mm-hmm. might have been there but just didn't stay in the rock.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
As I mentioned, you are the author of an encyclopedia of dinosaurs titled The Most Complete Up-to-Date Encyclopedia for Dinosaur Lovers of All Ages. Why, as a scientist, do you make time to write books aimed at kids?
Sure. I guess part of it is paying back. I mean, I can remember as a kid getting, you know, great pleasure and information and so forth and reading books about dinosaurs that some professionals and also, you know, non-scientists had written. Also, dinosaurs are in many ways the gateway to the sciences in general. I mean, dinosaurs are one of the first things that young people learn about, where from that you can start to talk about issues like anatomy and ecology and evolution and geologic time and environmental change. and a whole host of other disciplines. And that's actually not just true for kids 3 and 5 and 8 and so forth. It's true of undergraduates. I teach various classes at the University of Maryland for non-majors. And if they didn't have the word dinosaur in the title, I don't think students would be taking them. But because I use dinosaurs as the lure, I can introduce students from the, you know, business majors and arts and humanities majors and so forth to concepts like natural selection and geologic change and so forth.
So dinosaur as bait.
Absolutely.
But what is it about dinosaurs that seems to grab the attention of some kids? I won't say it's all kids. It didn't grab mine, mm-hmm. I confess. But and therefore, I'm kind of mystified about why do kids, some kids get so fanatic about dinosaurs?
Yeah, there are even, you know, child psychologists who've tried to figure this out. And there are a bunch of different ideas out there. And I think at least a couple of them are probably at play in any given kid who gets obsessed. One is that they're monsters that are real, but they're safe. So they're like dragons or giants or goblins or you know, space aliens, except you know that they actually existed, but they can't get you. So they're not going to be hiding underneath your bed or in your closet. So it's a way of getting at something that is big and scary, but can't hurt you. Another part of it, I think, is very similar to the types of reasons that Pokemon and other subjects attract kids, where it's a set of knowledge, especially of names and of classification, that kids can master and they can understand and learn how to classify and group things and mystify their parents, because the parents don't know that, but the kids will be able to use this language among themselves. Oh, yeah, you know, Sor Ornitholestes or whatever. So, yeah, they'll know what it's all about.
So the names, which I as a kid found like way complicated and sort of off-putting and kind of a barrier between me and getting interested in these defunct animals, for some kids that's a real draw.
I think so. It's a way of being able to put order to this set of weird things, and you know, good for them. It's a way to develop your mental skills in terms of classifying and memorizing and those kinds of things.
That is Dinosaur, University of Maryland dinosaur expert Thomas Holtz Jr. here on Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast, and you are welcome to be part of this conversation. Were you a dinosaur enthusiast as a child? Were you hooked on dinosaurs? Are you still? And what do you find compelling about them? Give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Dr. Holtz, in some interviews, you have criticized pop culture depictions of dinosaurs like Jurassic Park. What did Hollywood get wrong?
Yeah, those are a bunch of issues. I mean, one aspect is, given the nature of what Hollywood's trying to do, when they portray dinosaurs in films, they tend not to portray them as animals. They portray them as conflicts to overcome. And so they don't show them behaving the way they would have normally behaved most of the time. And that's important for narrative reasons. You don't want to do that. It's like if you have a lion in a movie, you don't show it lying around most of the time, which is what lions do most of the time. They're not mostly on the hunt. But if they're going to be interacting with the characters, you want to show them in a dynamic fashion. And so I think it gives people the impression that back in the Mesozoic, dinosaurs were spending all their time running around, roaring at each other and fighting, which they did some of the time, but not most of the time.
How do you know that?
Well, it's the sort of basic ecology that animals need to move around and feed, you know, enough to keep their bodies going, but it costs energy to do that. And it's better to spend more of your time, you know, on downtime and only have to get up and move around when there is a biological necessity for doing that. Additionally, the roaring all the time during fighting, you know, that's actually not a really sensible approach for hunting, particularly if the other animal hasn't seen you yet. It's like, don't roar at them before you attack, because then they'll know you're coming. And it might make for good drama, but it doesn't make for a good strategy.
But presumably roaring during an attack and other show ways to show ferociousness would have made sense.
Oh, absolutely. Also, sparring off against each other within a species. Certainly, there were all sorts of displays they would have used trying to establish a dominance or protecting territory or defending their young.
So you just think Hollywood just kind of missed the depiction of dinosaurs as beings, as animals.
Yeah, that's one of the elements of it. Another element, and I'm looking at you, Jurassic World, is the idea of the franchise being more important than the science. And this is what I and a lot of my colleagues call Jurassic World a missed opportunity. So when the first Jurassic Park movie came back in the 90s, the animators tried to incorporate as much of the new science that had been discovered in the 70s and the 80s to show to the public, a public that had been raised on the dinosaurs of the 1950s and 60s and beforehand. So these very old-fashioned tail-dragging dinosaurs, and suddenly they're active and dynamic. They're smarter than people had thought. They had complex behaviors. And that was great. It was one of the best examples of PR dinosaurs had in decades. But now, you know, it rolls around, it's a 20-teens, Jurassic World comes out, and the dinosaurs we see are the dinosaurs of the first movie, if not even more outdated than that. And they lacked the updating of the previous couple decades, the 90s, the early 2000s, and so forth.
And what should that updating have been?
Sure. So the most obvious aspect would have been feathers. So at least some of the dinosaurs that are in Jurassic Park, and the velociraptors being the key one, we absolutely know are from groups that are totally feathered as a bald eagle or a pigeon. In the 1990s, we didn't know that. So it was okay that the Jurassic Park team didn't show that. Some people were suspecting that might be true, but there wasn't the positive evidence. But we have that positive evidence now. Also, some of the dinosaurs in Jurassic World are more tail-dragging, even than they were in the first movie. And we know from their trackways that they didn't normally walk around with their tails dragging along and so forth. It's a sort of old image, but it's an outdated image. Now, in defense of Jurassic World, they actually have a character, the chief geneticist, state that what's in the park aren't really the true dinosaurs. If we showed you the real dinosaurs, most people wouldn't recognize them. Which, you know, we say, okay, within the story, yeah, but you could have done it. You could have shown it. You could even have said, you know, that old park, they had all that frog DNA stuck in there. Now we're going to show you real dinosaurs.
I want to pick up on both of those. We have to take a short break, but I want to know how you know what you know. I'm talking with Thomas Holtz Jr., paleontologist at the University of Maryland, a dinosaur specialist, a Tyrannosaurus Rex specialist, and you can be part of this conversation if you have a question about dinosaurs, what we know that we didn't know a couple of decades ago. Give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about dinosaurs with Thomas Holtz Jr., a paleontologist at the University of Maryland and author of a voluminous encyclopedia about dinosaurs. I want to pick up and let me just remind listeners, this is the perfect time. If you've had a question about dinosaurs and what we know about them and what we've learned about them recently, this is the time to ask it. Send us an email, midday@wypr.org, or phone us at 410-662-8780. Dr. Holtz, you said one of the things that we didn't know at the time of the we just were learning, I guess, at the time of the first Jurassic Park movie was that dinosaurs didn't actually drag their tails. I'm picturing fossils, mm-hmm. skeletons that are found, and an animal might be in whatever position, and usually you don't find a whole skeleton at once anyway. And so why not assume that gravity dragged a tail down, even if you see the vertebrae that make up that tail?
Sure. There's sort of two lines of evidence that we can use to get to this. One is the skeletal anatomy, or more importantly, our inference of the soft tissue anatomy that would have existed in that skeleton. So between the individual bones, we would have had the the caps between the vertebrae, just like we have the discs between our vertebrae. And so we have a sense of what the shape of the articulation, of the assembly of the vertebrae would be when you put them in their natural position. And it turns out when you reassemble them, they don't show this downward arc. They're relatively straight back. And additionally, there are attachments for powerful tendons along the top of the vertebrae that would help hold it up so that the tail wouldn't be dragging down. It would have been suspended by this powerful set of ligaments on top. And then the other line of evidence is from the other type of fossils. So one sort of fossils are the body fossils, the teeth and bones and so forth. The other sort are trace fossils. Trace fossils are things like footprints and burrows and nests and other things that the dinosaurs left behind as they were moving through the land. And from the trace fossils, we can look at their trackways where their feet impressions were, their foot impressions were. And we notice there isn't a tail drag mark between them. And even my little bearded dragon at home, which is only about, you know, a little more than a foot long, and especially something bigger like an iguana, they leave very clear tail drag marks as they're walking through the sand and mud. And yet we don't see them when 20-ton long-necked sauropod dinosaurs were walking along.
Huh. Interesting. Bethany has called us. Bethany, you have a question for Dr. Holtz?
Yes, and thank you for allowing me to ask my question, Sheila. I really enjoy the show.
Good.
My question for Mr. Holtz was, now knowing that dinosaurs actually had feathers, does that still classify them as reptiles? Because I remember growing up and learning about just dinosaurs in elementary school, and I worked for PBS. I watched a lot of Dinosaur Train. And I remember learning they were reptiles. So with the feathers, does that mean they're still reptiles, or does that classify them as a different type of species?
Ah, yes, that's a great question. And classification itself, the philosophy behind classification has undergone a really big change in the last several decades that really hasn't percolated out to the general public. And that is our new methods of classification. It's called cladistics. Means that when we name a group, you never stop being a member of that group. So a group is an ancestor and all of its descendants, no matter how much it changes. So if there is a group reptilia, and some people will use the word reptilia for everything that's more closely related to a true lizard, Lacerta, and crocodiles than they are to human beings, then dinosaurs are definitely reptiles. But by that definition, so are birds. In fact, birds, as it turns out, are a type of dinosaur. So birds and other dinosaurs are a type of reptile because in this sense, nothing in the definition of reptile means that you're cold-blooded, tail-dragging, or scaly. It simply is a position on a family tree. Now, if you use reptile in the old sense, that is for animals that are cold-blooded and scaly, and lay hard-shelled eggs, then most dinosaurs probably wouldn't have been reptiles in that sense. But biological classification has moved from these sort of qualitative approaches to groups to ones where we're specifying patterns of common ancestry. So you can say dinosaurs are reptiles, but when you say that, you have to recognize that birds are reptiles as well under that definition.
Bethany, I appreciate the question. Thank you, but I'm still stuck. I'm stuck before Bethany was, and it's kind of the same question I was asking about the tail. Mm-hmm. If most of what we know about dinosaurs is from fossils of hard structures like mm-hmm. bones, how on earth do we know whether or not there were feathers?
Yes, and that's the reason we didn't really know until the 1990s. We had worked out from the skeletons that birds were descendants of dinosaurs. And in fact, you look at their skeletons, and Velociraptor and Archaeopteryx, the oldest bird, are more similar to each other than Velociraptor is to a Tyrannosaurus or that Archaeopteryx is to a hummingbird. But still, there was the possibility that feathers arose after the bird line split from the raptor line. Well, in the 1990s, a series of wonderful deposits were found, mostly in China, although we have some now also in Siberia, where the sediments where the creatures died and settled down were extremely fine-grained, very, very fine-grained. And the water at the bottom of these lakes that they were forming in was anoxic, that is, without oxygen. And with no oxygen there, the worms, the clams, and so forth can't live, and they can't disturb the bodies that lie down there. So the soft tissue or impressions of the soft tissue actually exist. So entire flowers can be found. A flower doesn't normally preserve in the rock, but they are found there. When you find lizards down there, you can see the scales on the body. When you find the tiny mammals down there, you see the fur on the body. And when the dinosaurs are found there, we find the remains of feathers. In some cases, very simple feathers, sort of a fuzz-like structure, sort of like the down of a chick, perhaps. But in some cases, and in the raptors, for instance, it's honest-to-goodness feathers. I mean, feathers with a shaft down them and branches coming off that and branches coming off that and so forth. Something where if you found it on the street in a fresh state, you wouldn't be able to tell it wasn't from a modern bird.
Marty in Baltimore has written us with, I think, a question that pertains to the relationship between dinosaurs and birds. My favorite dinosaur as a kid, Marty writes, was, I'm going to mispronounce this, I think, was Deinonychus?
Deinonychus, yes.
Deinonychus, with its lithe limbs and terrifying claws. Then they showed up in Jurassic Park, but they called them velociraptors. Velociraptors were like pretty big turkeys. This is an egregious fraud that must be addressed, Marty writes.
Sure. If Velociraptor was like a big turkey, it turns out, unfortunately, Deinonychus was sort of like a much bigger turkey. So the Deinonychus and Velociraptor are two very closely related forms. In fact, there's a dinosaur paleontologist and artist, Greg Paul, who actually considers them part of the same name. He considers Deinonychus to be a type of Velociraptor. And in fact, that's what inspired Michael Crichton when he wrote Jurassic Park to call his dinosaurs Velociraptor, when based on the size, they're actually about the size of Deinonychus. True Velociraptor is a small animal. Its skull is no bigger than my hand. Deinonychus is a bigger animal, about the size of a timber wolf. But they're both extremely closely related, and although we don't have the skin impressions of either Deinonychus or Velociraptor directly, we don't have them found in either in these lake deposits for either of those. Every other species of dromaeosaur or raptor dinosaur we found where we have the outside of it have the total feathered body. So we can infer that Velociraptor and Deinonychus were totally feathered, sort of the same way that we can look at the skeleton of early horses and infer that they were furry, even though we don't find the fur there, because we know that the living representatives of the group have it, and the more distant relatives, when we find their impressions in the sediment, they also have fur.
This is Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about dinosaurs with Thomas Holtz, Jr., paleontologist and dinosaur expert at the University of Maryland. What are your questions about dinosaurs? This is the perfect time to ask them. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. Sid... Oh, wait, let me actually, yeah, I'm going to hold Sid's question. Sid, we will get there. But Alex in Baltimore writes, I'm waiting to turn my younger son onto Dino Dan and Dinosaur Train, which I found very informative. I'm curious what Dr. Holtz thinks of these shows. Also, is Brontosaurus back? I understood a few years ago that Apatosaurus was the same dinosaur named first, but not as well known. And then I recently heard that Brontosaurus is back. Just want to make sure I have my facts straight before I start indoctrinating the little guy.
Sure. Okay, that's a lot of questions here, but I'll get through them. I can't say that I've seen Dino Dan, so I can't speak to that. But I can say Dinosaur Train is a most excellent show. It is a great way to teach kids not only about dinosaurs and the ancient world, but also the methods of science. I mean, one of the statements in every episode is one of the characters will say, you know, a hypothesis, a question you can test. So they get right to the heart of what is science, that science isn't just a body of knowledge. It's a way of trying to understand our world by answering questions. And in fact, the main scientific consultant there for Dr. Scott, who shows up on the show occasionally. He is a real dinosaur paleontologist. He's a colleague of mine. He's done a lot of important research on dinosaurs from all around the world. But he has now lent a lot of his expertise to educating the next generation to get them while they're young by using this, you know, fun TV show to talk about dinosaurs.
So that's a good source.
Absolutely. With regard
Brontosaurus.
Brontosaurus, that's right. So in the I have to go back in time a bit here. In the not as far back as the dinosaurs, though. In the 1870s, two giant dinosaurs are found within 2 years of each other in the American West. And what the first one found is named Apatosaurus ajax. And another almost as big one is found shortly thereafterwards and given the name Brontosaurus excelsus. These are both, you know, giant dinosaurs. They're known from pretty good skeletons. In the 19th century, they were considered two separate forms. At the dawn of the 20th century, some people who worked on these dinosaurs said, you know, we really can't tell these two apart that much. We feel that excelsus is not distinct enough from ajax to really say they're as different from each other as wolves are from foxes. And so therefore, they have to have the same first part of the name, the same genus name. Since Apatosaurus was named first, Brontosaurus became Apatosaurus excelsus. Well, just recently, a brand new comprehensive study of that entire branch of the long-necked dinosaurs that includes Brontosaurus and Apatosaurus and Diplodocus and so forth was done. And in that study, the scientists involved found that the excelsus species and a couple other ones weren't nested. They weren't descendant from other creatures that we had been calling Apatosaurus. And so they allowed them to justify the return of Brontosaurus. Now, it doesn't obligate us to use Brontosaurus. We could just use Apatosaurus for an even larger group now than we did before, and that would be consistent with their findings. But it allows us now to have a justification for a distinct group that we call Brontosaurus. And since that's one of the most awesome names, not as good as Tyrannosaurus, but almost as good, I'm all for using Brontosaurus again.
John in Baltimore has a question. John, welcome to Midday.
Hey, I'm curious, why may dinosaurs have evolved feathers? What are some reasons?
Sure. Well, for the ancestral state, where it's sort of this downy form, this sort of primitive feather state, which is the most widely distributed among dinosaurs, it's probably a combination of display. So feathers can hold all sorts of colors, as we know, when we look at it at the birds of the world. But also for insulation, because they mostly show up in small-bodied dinosaurs. So small-bodied dinosaurs have a big surface area to their volume. And if they have an active metabolism, unless you have something to trap that heat and keep it in the body, they'll lose a lot of their energy. And it's the reason that Chihuahuas are shaking all the time. They're actually cold. They don't have the fur that a other small dog would have. It could have also been used to help brood their eggs. If they're lying on their eggs, having a fuzzy body covering could help hold it. Now, for the feather-looking feathers, what we technically call pinnaceous feathers, those probably have additional functions. I mean, part of it might help in terms of display because they are broader. Part of it might help to brood even more because they cover a greater area. But they also have aerodynamic functions. And it turns out that when we look at modern young birds, birds that aren't yet able to actually fly, but they can flap their arms back and forth, the surface area of their feathers are enough to help them generate traction through their feet when they run up the side of a tree. And so you can actually film baby birds and some older birds too, flapping their wings back and forth and are able to literally run up the side of a tree to go and hide. Now, having an adaptation that allows you to more quickly get up in a tree and hide is useful for all sorts of animals because there's always other bigger animals out there wanting to eat you. And that's a selective pressure that would have existed in the Jurassic and the Cretaceous just as it does today. So that could get us to forms that now are up in the trees at least part of the time. And then it's one or possibly more than one branch of those dinosaurs that then take those feathers even further to make them aerodynamic in the way that modern birds do. That is for powered flight.
John, I appreciate the question. I want to take it one step further because when we talk about birds being descendants of dinosaurs. Mm-hmm. Is it because of the feather evidence, or I thought it was because of skeletal evidence?
Right. It was the skeletal evidence that is what convinced scientists. There are many, many, many attributes from essentially every part of the body, from the snout all the way to the tip of the tail, where birds, particularly earlier birds that haven't been as transformed, can show us features that are found only otherwise among certain types of carnivorous dinosaurs. So birds are nested among the small-bodied carnivorous dinosaurs and, in fact, are very closely related to the raptors. Things like Velociraptor and Deinonychus are the closest relatives to birds that we don't currently call birds.
Hmm. We need to take a quick break. I want to pick up on the question of why dinosaurs went extinct and why the bird line of dinosaurs did not. So we'll talk about that when we get back with Thomas Holtz, Jr., a paleontologist at the University of Maryland and author of a voluminous encyclopedia about dinosaurs. You can be part of this conversation. Send us your question by email to midday@wypr.org or phone us at 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. If you're just joining us, we're talking today about dinosaurs, what we've learned in the last several decades, and what researchers hope to learn in the coming years. I'm speaking with Thomas Holtz, Jr., a vertebrate paleontologist at the University of Maryland. You can join our conversation. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. Sid has written us. Sid says, biology has been famously derided as stamp collecting in the past, but I think this aspect of it is exactly what makes dinosaurs so appealing to kids. Kids love to dive into encyclopedic minutiae, whether it is collectible card games or fictional worlds like Harry Potter. Dinosaurs are a great example of that. Also, what's with T-Rex's arms? Do any other dinosaurs have such small vestigial arms? I think Gregory has a question about that, too. Gregory, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. I look at the back in those times, there was plenty of food, plenty of oxygen, a lot warmer climate. Why would they need to be predators? It seemed like most of the dinosaurs had been scavengers.
Well, scavenging, it turns out, is kind of a difficult way of life if you're an obligate scavenger. That is, if you never kill any prey. Energetically, the chance that you will always be able to find enough dead bodies around becomes difficult. There's a recent paper, actually, that suggested that there's a best size to be a scavenger, and that would be an animal much smaller than Tyrannosaurus rex, that by the time you're up to Tyrannosaurus, that's sort of a way too big to make your living having to hope to find dead animals around there. And having small arms is not a detriment to being a predator. It's only a detriment to being a predator if you're a cat. Wolves do not use their arms to seize their prey. Hyenas, which spotted hyenas are predators, don't use their arms to seize the prey. Eagles, they use their feet, but they don't use their arms to seize their prey. And so snakes obviously don't. They don't have any arms. There are plenty of ways of being a predator that don't require the arms. And in fact, the arms would only get in the way of the most powerful bite among all dinosaurs, which is what Tyrannosaurus rex had, this hugely massive, deeply rooted, bone-piercing teeth, and with a reinforced skull and massive jaw muscles.
You have to explain that to me. First, I want to tell our listeners, there's this dreamy expression that comes over Dr. Holtz's face when he describes Tyrannosaurus rex. There's some kind of love affair going on here. But if you're going to bite, if you're going to chew something up, I guess I'm just projecting. It seems to me you'd want to be able to hold it at whatever distance from your massive jaw that you'd like to. And if your arms limit that, that seems like a problem. It seems like evolution would have changed that.
Sure. In the case of tyrannosaurs, they seem to have done the route that that some of the big dogs and so forth do, which is you just sort of grasp and kill with your jaws, and then after the thing's dead, well, it doesn't actually have to be after the thing's done. Just rip off big chunks of it. In fact, we have a horn of a triceratops and the backbones of a duckbill where they were bitten off while alive. And we know this because the triceratops and the duckbill got away and they healed. They healed from these bites. So we know the Tyrannosaurus went after these animals while they were still living.
And the fact that they healed indicates to me that his small arms were not particularly effective.
Yeah. Yeah. The things, predators actually only succeed about, you know, one third of the time or so. It's just nature shows when you're watching that you don't get to see that because they don't want to show you all the misses. Now, Tyrannosaurus rex is not unique in having those tiny arms. Its entire family, the Tyrannosauridae, have these really short arms. And independently, another group of predators, the predators that dominated the southern hemisphere at the same time the Tyrannosaurs were around, which is the end of the age of dinosaurs, the southern hemisphere guys called the Abelisaurids, their arms were even more reduced. So apparently, those dinosaurs that have really powerful neck muscles and jaw muscles could get away without having grasping hands.
Hmm. Lynn has called us from Hagerstown. Lynn, welcome to Midday.
Hi, thank you so much. My question involves pterodactyls. When you're talking about feathers and having evolved from dinosaurs, what happened to the pterodactyl? Did they become bats? Did they have feathers? Because they were very large animals, weren't they?
Well, some of them were. So actually, something that I haven't done, which I should do quickly, is define what a dinosaur is. So to a scientist, a dinosaur is any descendant of the most recent common ancestor of Megalosaurus and Iguanodon, which were two of the first discovered dinosaurs. They represent the two major branches. So pterodactyls aren't dinosaurs, but they are pretty closely related. So they didn't come from that ancestor, but there are a couple branches out on the family tree. Pterodactyls are sort of dinosaurs' funny-looking flying cousins. They didn't become bats. They are entirely extinct. The last pterosaurs died out 66 million years ago. But they were bat-like in some context. Instead of feathers, pterosaurs had a kind of fur-like fuzz. Now, it may be evolutionarily derived from the same thing that dinosaur fuzz is like, if which so the common ancestor of the two of them may have been fuzzy. We don't know for certain that's true yet, but it's a possibility. But pterosaurs, like pterodactyls and their kin, were not mammals. They were, in fact, members of this larger group with dinosaurs called the archosaurs. True bats are, in fact, mammals. They are cousins of primates and horses and all the other placental mammals. But the actual origin of bats is one of the great mysteries in vertebrate paleontology. And somewhere out there, there's fossils of non-flying proto-bats, and we either aren't recognizing them or they haven't been found, which just goes to show this is a science of discovery, and we're always making new finds out in the fields and in the museums.
We should probably briefly explain why dinosaurs went extinct.
Sure. So 66 million years ago, the Earth was struck by a very large asteroid, an asteroid about 10 to 15 kilometers in diameter. That's about the size of Manhattan Island or Mount Everest, which generated a blast of something like 10 to the 18th megatons, or 1,000 to 10,000 times the strength of the global nuclear arsenal at the height of the Cold War. So picture 10,000 World War III's fought on a single day at a single spot.
Wow.
And that blasted up a huge chunk of Mexico, because the impact was actually in Mexico, which had a series of effects. First, there was the shock wave and the tsunamis from that. But then some of the material rained back down quickly onto the Earth and burning up on reentry, and that caused a thermal pulse that affected the surface of the water, and especially the land. So anything that wasn't able to hide would be basically like an easy bake oven for a while. So it wouldn't necessarily burst into flame, but it'd be like under a heat lamp. And being under a heat lamp is not a good, healthy condition for most animals or plants.
And we're talking about that heat staying for days and weeks.
Well, this pulse of the thermal pulse is probably just hours and minutes, but it's enough to sort of bake things around the world. And then the next major stressor is the material that didn't fall down right away, because that stayed in the atmosphere
and blotted out the sun.
Blocking out the sun, exactly. An age of darkness for months, maybe a year, but definitely months, and that's cutting off the base of the food chain. The algae doesn't get any food in the sea. The plants don't get food on land. The herbivores starve. The carnivores do really well for a short period of time and then starve. And then only things that are relatively small or had low metabolic rates or could otherwise eat from a pantry were able to survive. And modern birds, or the ancestor of modern birds, are one of those groups that could feed from a pantry.
What do you mean by that? Feed from the pantry?
Yeah, feed from a pantry. So many types of animals have to have basically fresh food. Their pathway to get nutrients is direct from sunlight to living plants, to the animals that eat those living plants, to the animals that eat that. But some animals can access stored food. So in the sea, an example of that would be crabs. Crabs are bottom feeders. There's food that's accumulated over time on the base of the seafloor. They could eat that. Well, modern toothless birds can eat seeds. And seeds can last for a long period of time. They don't have to be fresh. Whereas many of the other dinosaurs, including the other types of birds that went extinct but were toothed birds, they couldn't get enough food during that interval. And it looks like that factor, the ability to access this stored food, was the key for the ancestors of living birds to survive, whereas all their, in my opinion, more majestic cousins died out.
And I just want to, as you were describing this cataclysmic event 66 million years ago, that time from then to now is only about half the time period that dinosaurs roamed the Earth, right?
Exactly. So that Tyrannosaurus Rex, for instance, is one of the very last dinosaurs, or one of the very last giant dinosaurs. It is closer in time to us than it was to Stegosaurus. Stegosaurus lived 150 million years ago, and it was halfway through the age of dinosaurs. The first dinosaurs show up about 230 to 235 million years ago. So there isn't an age of dinosaur. Really, it's an ages of dinosaurs. And the world went through tremendous changes between the first dinosaurs and the Great Extinction, just as it has since that Great Extinction and today.
Tom has called us from Baltimore with a question about the situation in Maryland. Tom, welcome to Midday.
Hi, everybody. I was just wondering, Tom, Dinosaur Alley between Baltimore and D.C., have any large predatory dinosaur remains ever been found along that area?
Yeah, we have
Tell us about Dinosaur Alley.
Sure. So the eastern part of North America isn't one of the great places to find dinosaur fossils, but Maryland happens to be the best place in the eastern part of North America to find fossils, dinosaur fossils, or at least one of the best. And it's mostly a band of Cretaceous rocks that run almost paralleling Route 95, actually. So starting around College Park, so not actually terribly far from my office, up through Baltimore. Unfortunately, it's in very small pockets. It's not well exposed. And it was kind of a quiet environment without a lot of sediment accumulating at the time. So we don't get things that look like Dinosaur National Monument, where dozens of individuals were buried in a short period of time and so forth. But we do find bits and pieces. And some of the bits and pieces we find are the teeth of Acrocanthosaurus. Now, Acrocanthosaurus is a carnivorous dinosaur that we know from rocks of the same age in Oklahoma and in Texas, and very similar dinosaurs in Montana and Wyoming. It was one of the biggest carnivorous dinosaurs that lived in North America until Tyrannosaurus Rex. It's a 4 to 5 ton giant. Unlike Tyrannosaurus, it actually had really powerful, although still short, arms. It had very powerful, muscled, three-fingered arms. And we know from a trackway from Texas that actually it was a hunter of even larger dinosaurs, where the trackway of the big long-necked plant eaters going along, and the meat eater, the Acrocanthosaurus, was chasing it along. We even see where it attacked it, because it goes from left, right, left, and then two left feet in a row. So it's bitten or grabbed on to the plant eater, is carried a step, and then falls off again. So we have the teeth of Acrocanthosaurus
here. It's like
a
dinosaur cartoon. You're reading into the into the ground.
Exactly. And in fact, that's why, you know, footprints are so great, because the footprints are made by the animals while they're still alive. They're not just the remains of dead things. So, yes, we did have giant dinosaurs here in the rocks of Dinosaur Alley. There's just not a lot of them, because giant meat eaters are always about the rarest thing in any environment.
Tom, thanks for that call. We have an email from Robert asking, did all dinosaurs lay eggs? Did they bury them, sit on them? How long in the mother? How long in the nest?
Wow, those are some great questions. As far as we know, all dinosaurs did lay eggs. We have eggs of most of the major groups of dinosaurs, at least. And like modern birds, they were crispy eggs. So they weren't the leathery eggs we find in lizards and crocodilians and so forth. They were actually very crispy. Crocodilian eggs are a little crispy. And we can tell that because we actually have the egg shell. Some of them did seem to bury the eggs, at least partially. Other ones seem to have had them more exposed on the surface. And there have been cases where raptor dinosaurs and their close kin, the oviraptors, which were sort of beaked, omnivorous bird-like dinosaurs, they're found on top of the nests. So they were brooding the eggs. Not coincidentally, these are the two groups with the biggest feathers on the wings or the arms. And feathers probably, those big arm feathers probably helped to shield those eggs. But something like a giant long-necked 20-ton or 100-ton sauropod obviously can't brood its eggs. That would be a quick way to go extinct. So they would dig holes in the ground and then just pile the eggs up in there. They may have actually protected the nest site, and that's something we can't see directly. But we can look at their modern relatives, the descendants of dinosaurs, the birds, which are living dinosaurs, and their closest living cousins, which are the crocodilians, alligators, crocodiles, gavials. And both those groups actually protect the nest, even if they don't sit on top of the eggs. And we can infer that this state would have been present at the common ancestor of crocodilians and of birds, and therefore dinosaurs would have inherited that trait, because they're also descendants of that ancestor. And so very likely, dinosaurs as different as Triceratops and Tyrannosaurus and Stegosaurus and Brontosaurus all did look after the nest to one way or another.
We have just a half a minute left, and this has been such an interesting conversation. I hear you describing all this, and I can't imagine there's anything left to learn about dinosaurs. But I'm probably wrong. So tell us one thing you're hoping to learn.
What is actually on the body covering of Tyrannosaurus rex? We know it came from fuzzy ancestors. Was T-Rex fuzzy? Did it have a mane? Was it totally scaly? Had it lost its feathers? We still don't know the answer to that. And either way, it's a cool answer.
The whole conversation is very cool. I really want to thank you.
Thanks.
Dr. Thomas Holtz, Jr., paleontologist at the University of Maryland. Thanks.
Sure.
I also want to thank Kenilworth Farms Market for providing lunch today. The Farmers Market is located next to Atwater's at the Shops at Kenilworth. Open Tuesdays 3:30 to 6:30 p.m. now through November 22nd. Vendors offer local and organic fruits and vegetables, meat, eggs, cheese, pastries, honey, wine, and more. Information at thekenilworthmarket.com. And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow. Syria is the site of many remnants of our earliest civilizations. The war in Syria has reduced many ancient archaeological sites to rubble. What have we lost? What's being done to protect what remains? Join us tomorrow for that. I'm Sheila Cast. Have a great afternoon.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.